Here we go. Welcome to Spilling Ink, guys. Everybody out there in the audience, this is the talk show that takes you behind the book to meet the authors and professionals in the publishing industry. We are missing someone today, Jane.
I know. Yeah. So we'll actually keep on task, probably.
Shame. No, he's got a good enough reason for not being here. So everybody send a hug out to Jason. Make sure that you tell him you love him. I think he had a bad day today. But anyways, you have us and it is all the ladies today. Look at this. Yay. We haven't had an all ladies panel in a while. You guys know me. I'm Katie Solitis. You know Jane. But let's introduce you to our editors today that we're going to talk to. We talked to Christy 2 weeks ago. Was it Christy?
I think so.
We're going to let Ellen go first and let her introduce herself. Then we'll swing it over to you. How's that sound?
Great.
All right. Take it away, Ellen.
Thanks, Katie. So I'm Ellen. I'm based in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And I am full-time a freelance editor, and I specialize in science fiction and fantasy, along with some crime and horror occasionally as well. And I'm also the owner and publisher of Constellate Publishing, which I launched in November, and I publish a monthly digital periodical with short fiction and art and illustrations and stuff, which has been a lot of fun to work on.
Great.
Very cool. Christy?
I'm Christy Stratus. You guys may know me already since I was on a few times. And I'm also a full-time editor. That's my full-time job now. Left my corporate job a year ago. But I've had my company for 6 years now. And you can find me at proofpositivepro.com. I do edit all genres. I also have another editor on staff. So there's two of us. And I'm also an acquiring editor for City Owl Press. That's a small press focused on romance or books that have a strong romantic element to them. And I'm also an author. I have a couple of books out. They're both in the Dark Victoriana collection. One is called Anatomy of a Darkened Heart, and one is called Brotherhood of Secrets. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Now I have a serious question for you guys. How much sleep do you get at night?
Not a lot. What is the sleep concept you speak of?
You get about 7 hours.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I mean, writing takes over your life, but you guys take it to another level with editing on top of that. So where do you find the time? Something's got to be sacrificed, right? And it's usually sleep.
It's pretty much always sleep. Yeah. I schedule myself. I recently invested more money than I ever thought I would spend on a day planner. And I don't regret it for a second. I like the one that I use. I got it through Agendio, so it's perfectly customizable. So I can have my weekly task list, which is really important to me because every day is different. I don't necessarily have to do specific things on specific days because I have a little bit of flexibility within my projects and all the things that I do. So having the weekly task list was really important to me because then every day I can just pick and choose the things that I'm going to work on that fit in my schedule, in the mood that I'm in that day. Or if I'm sick, I can work on something that requires less brain power and things like that. So that's how I manage it. But it's definitely a lot to juggle.
And of course, being a freelancer, you have to schedule in your days off, right?
What are days off?
Yeah, exactly.
Vacation days? Yeah. Man, yeah. Spends at least half the day working. But maybe a little bit of time off. But yeah, it's definitely scheduling. I agree with Ellen. It's, you do need to switch it up a lot of the time. And maybe people picture editors working just like straight through the day, and we do. But sometimes we need to like, and I'm sure you do the same thing, Ellen, like you just said. Sometimes we'll need to like work on one project all day, and we're saying, you know, we're making a lot of progress on this, or there's just so much to be done here that I just need total focus on this for the whole day. And then other times it's just like, let me do three in a day. Like, let me split it up. Here are my hours. You know, let me dedicate this time to that and this time to. So like you end up doing it your own way, but it is really nice. Since it's not, you know, for both of us, it's not corporate. We sort of, although we have deadlines, we can set it up the way we want to. And I find that to be extremely freeing and helpful. And obviously the client has to agree to the timeline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know the time that I'm going to need. So it's much better than having it handed to you and, you know, finish this by this date. And you're like, oh, well, great. I have 20 other projects. No way. I'm so glad to not do that anymore. It's very helpful. But things like, you know, agendas, you know, calendars, things like that are so useful. Setting reminders, forcing yourself to stop at some point and like either take a walk or just look away from the computer, you know, something. You definitely need to force yourself a little bit, because once you get into it, you're really into it.
Exactly. Yeah, you brought up a lot of really good points there. One thing I wanted to highlight, though, is I often will work on 3 or 4 different things in a day. And that's because some of the editing work that I do, like the line editing and the copy editing, is so detail focused that if I do it for any longer than 4 or 5 hours in a day, I lose focus and I start missing things. So in order for me to give my clients the best work that I can do, I only work on their project for 4 or 5 hours a day. And then I switch off to something else and I'll work on, you know, my social media stuff or something that's design or website design or something that's going to be checked again later anyway, something that requires a little bit less brain power, because I can only focus on details for so long in a day, right? Mm-hmm. So I find that really important, and that I love the freedom of freelance for that, because I have that flexibility to switch up and work on different projects in a day.
Yeah, it's tough holding down a full-time job and then trying to do the writing and the editing and the e-zine and the publishing company, you know. Some of us do that.
Yeah, I was in your position a year ago. Yeah. I totally understand. I started my company while I was in, you know, my corporate job, and it was very hard. It really was hard. Sometimes, you know, trying to juggle more than one manuscript really depends on the corporate life is unpredictable. And
it's life sucking sometimes.
It is. You're exhausted by the end of the day, whenever that is, you know, yeah, and it's so tired. And then what happens, your entire weekend, you don't get any time off, of course, yeah. You're just working on everything else. And sometimes still the corporate job. So, you know, yeah, I understand that.
I totally get that, but from a different perspective, because I started my company in my last semester of my undergrad degree. So then I took a year off. And then I went back to school to get my master's degree in publishing. So I was running my editing business while working towards a master's degree. And they highly recommend that you don't work outside of your classwork, because the program that I took at Simon Fraser University, it's an intensive like 2-semester master's program. So I was full time. I was on campus 7 a.m. till like 6 or 7 p.m. Monday to Friday. And that was all coursework. And then I had, you know, homework to do when I got home. Plus, you know, I wasn't taking on a lot of clients at that time, obviously, but I had to pay tuition somehow. So I was taking on a little bit and doing what I could. And it's a lot to juggle.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk on that subject real quick about taking on clients, because as an author, I look for freelance editors when I'm ready to get my project out. So I know what I look for, but what do you as a freelance editor look for in a client?
Great question. You want to take this one first?
Go ahead, because that's a really interesting question.
For me, I find a lot of my clients at conventions, so in person. So they're usually people that I've had a face-to-face interaction with. And I find that helps a lot, because you really get to know, one of the most important things for me when I'm working with anyone is to know that we can have a good professional relationship, because it's not just you handing your book to me working on it, and then me giving it back to you. That's not what editing is to me. There's more of an author-editor relationship there. So I need to know that when we communicate, we're communicating clearly, so that I know what you want and you know what I can do and what I will do on your manuscript. But also afterwards, like after I give you your manuscript back, that's not the end of it for me. I'm not sure how other editors work. Christy, I'm not sure how you work, but once I hand back a manuscript, I'm open to questions. And if you have questions mm-hmm. about some of the comments that I made, or you need clarification on anything, or you aren't sure why I did a specific style change, or whatever it might be, like, there's constant communication afterwards. And I also work with a lot of series authors. So when I'm editing book one, I know that I'm not just editing book one. I'm also going to be editing book two, book three, book four, and however long it goes on. So that author-editor relationship is really important, because to me, it's not just right now. It's not just that one book. It's going to continue. And so making sure that we can have good communication and we're on the same page and we, you know, get along is really, really important. So that's one thing I look for. And when I'm not meeting my clients face to face first, which happens often, I mean, we are in the age of the internet. I always make sure there are a few emails back and forth before either of us commit to anything, just to make sure that we have the bones there of a good, positive working relationship.
That's pretty important. And you do develop almost a language with your editor, especially if you're a series writer and they've edited mm-hmm. one book, and let's say you're onto the next book. Well, you've already kind of created a style sheet of what's going to happen in the next book, which words get emphasized, capitalized, what the crutch words are. You know,
I've got to need a map. Like, there are so many resources that I reuse book to book.
And I've got an editor who always hits me up for my crutch words, and she knows what my crutch words are, and she doesn't have to even mark them anymore. She just says, you know, this is the word. And I'm like, damn it, I know. I'll go find and get them all before the manuscript sent over, because she knows that I will always fall back on these crutch words.
Mm-hmm. Or certain like styles of phrasing sentences mm-hmm. or things that are often overused. Editors will really start to pick up on that. And one thing I really like too about working with series writers is seeing the progress. So I'll edit book one and it'll be, you know, it'll be a good book, but needs some work. And then we work on it and I answer the questions and everything else. And then they give me book two. And I had this happen with a client last year, and I'm working on book three with him very soon, actually next month. And he gave me book two and I was like, wow, not only did you look at my edits and make book one better, but your writing for book two got better too, because you saw the comments I was making, and seeing that improvement from book one to book two is just, it's amazing. It's really satisfying.
And that's really off how it should there. Be. No, that's how it should be. You should be learning from your editor, you know, as you go, so you don't make those same mistakes. And that in turn makes the editing process that much easier the next go around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome.
I try not to be woefully comma deficient.
I still use the Shatner comma. I'm sorry.
You're the opposite of me. I'm like, okay. I'm learning about the commas. Where do they go?
I just sprinkle commas in wherever.
And that's why you have an editor.
Exactly.
All right, Christy, let's hear your side of it. What do you look for in your clients?
Well, I agree that it's definitely you should have an ongoing relationship. And I know that answers a little bit of what an editor should be also. If someone is unwilling to answer questions, you know, as an editor, I would say that's no good. But, you know, for both of us, definitely I would say we answer questions. I mean, I've answered questions months afterward. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. an author is just super busy and doesn't have time to go over, you know, the critique or the edit until like a half a year later. And then they come back and, you know, I don't want to just say like, look, it's been a long time. Sometimes I have to go back and reread things. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it works. They've already paid. You want a relationship, not just a transaction. So, you know, I'm willing to do that for sure. So there are some things like for me, I always say, let's do a sample edit because I want them to like what I'm doing, but I also mm-hmm. want to see what their writing style is. And it's very rare, but here and there is a client that will just take so much work that it is something not worth what I would be paid. This is pretty rare. It's sometimes a non-native speaker. Maybe you've run into this, Ellen. It could be a non-native speaker who I don't mind non-native speakers at all. In fact, that is one thing I used to say on my website was a specialty until I got a client asking to work with me who like sort of barely spoke English. And that's something I can't help with because it's rewriting. Right. And I'm definitely not here to rewrite the whole book for you. You know, that's not an editor. You're looking for a ghostwriter at that point. So that's too much, you know. And then, you know, in most other cases, even if it's a heavy edit and it's bordering on not worth it, I usually take it because I do want to help that author and sort of guide them as to how the book could be improved and why it's having, you know, this many issues that maybe they've contacted me about, specific issues even. So I usually do take that stuff on, but I do want to do a sample edit to know what I'm getting, you know, so I need to know how much time I'm going to spend on it as well. I may need to tack on a few extra days just to make sure that I have the time to really dig in to something that needs a lot of help. So, you know, I usually make that really clear. I do have some people who are author assistants and things like that who will recommend clients to me or recommend me to clients, and then they come to me. And, you know, I know the author assistant and I know that they only work with great authors, so I'm less likely to ask for a sample at that point. But, you know, if it's someone out of the blue, definitely want a sample of their work.
And that's just good business right there. You know, getting a sample edit lets the author know the style of the editor and what they can do, just as well as it lets you know how much work it's going to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. I never quote before seeing a sample. I get these emails all the time asking for a general quote or like, my manuscript is approximately this long, you know, how much will that cost? Well, I need to look at it. I need to determine if you need a line edit, a heavy copy edit, a copy edit, a proofread, maybe even a developmental edit. And they might say in their email, oh, I need a copy edit. But not everybody understands what those terms really mean. So I always, always, always look at a sample before I quote to make sure that we're on the same page. And I'll always explain in my email with the quote exactly what I'm going to do, along with the sample edit that shows it. Mm-hmm. So always with new clients, I require at least 10 or 15 pages of a sample, and I'll edit the first two or three pages and then give a really long detailed email explaining what I would do to the rest of the manuscript. And then again, that comes with that professional communication and that working relationship, making sure that we're always on the same page about what's going to happen.
Now that leads us into a really important topic for any of our audience members or any of our listeners later on for the podcast. There are different levels of editing, and not everybody understands what those different levels mean. So can you ladies break it down for us and kind of give us a quick rundown of the different types of edits that you do and what they entail?
Yeah, absolutely. So the highest level is a developmental edit, also can be referred to as a substantial or structural edit. Those three terms are usually used pretty interchangeably. And that's looking at story structure, plot, character arcs. Sometimes you're cutting entire chapters, entire scenes, combining characters, or things that are really on the higher level there. And then the levels that I mostly focus on and I usually work with are line edits, which can also be called stylistic edit, and copy edit. So the line or stylistic is more, I usually describe it as a paragraph by paragraph and line by line kind of level. So you're looking at flow, consistency, word usage, things like that. And then the copy edit is mostly grammatical and punctuation, typos, more of the nitty gritty errors. And then there's proofreading, of course, which is after the manuscript has been typeset. And that's kind of a copy edit on the typeset version. So not only are you looking for those last minute typos that snuck through, but you're also looking at design inconsistencies. So if a font randomly switches or things like that, page numbers and stuff.
Yeah, I offer similar services. I list developmental edit, copy edit, and proofreading on my site. But, and they're very similar to what you're talking about. Somebody will maybe contact me and ask for something specific. Sometimes they say, I don't want you to touch, you know, this end of things, but I'd like you to just work on that end of things. And so, you know, that's totally doable. Usually, you know, an editor should be able to switch it up and give you a fair price on that, you know? And so I do like the basic services, of course. And then if you needed something separate, I could definitely do that. I do work on synopsis, book blurbs, things like that as well. So if that's something you're interested in, you know, I've done a number of those. If I've edited your manuscript and you want me to write a book blurb, that's another thing that I can do. But I do recommend you look at my book blurbs that I've written in the past, because if it's not your style, then you don't want me to do it, obviously. Don't just pay someone to do a book blurb unless you see what their style is. It can be pretty different, and you need it to not only draw people in, but it needs to match the genre. So that's a little bit off topic, but just in case you see that service somewhere. But yeah, it's Ellen described it perfectly. And the thing to watch out for is you want to look at each person's website, an editor's website, because you know how it is, sometimes they define something differently. And somebody, you know, even though proofreading should be one thing, sometimes an editor will define it as another for whatever reason. So you just want to make sure that you know what you're getting before you pay for it.
You hit on a really, really important topic though, too, about style, not just on the book blurb, but editorial style is important too. And that's why it's very important for authors to feel out the editor just as much as the editor should be feeling out the author. Because as an author, you don't want to have your voice edited out by an editor you don't mesh with.
And that's why the sample edit is so, so important. And even if a client doesn't ask for one, I'll do it anyway, because we both need to know that our styles match. And it's really important that that the editor isn't editing to their own style, that they're actually editing to the author's style. That's something that I was trained to do in editorial specific classes. And I see people all the time in editors groups saying, hey, I'm really good at English. I have an English degree, so I think I'm going to be an editor. And that's a really great start. But I always highly recommend taking editorial specific classes, because you learn those types of things that you don't get in a generic English program. And those things are so important to the day-to-day job.
Absolutely. And we've got some comments coming in from the crowd here. Joe especially, and he's got a question for us, which I'm going to read out for our podcast listeners for later on, that I thought was really important. And I know I talked to you guys before the show, and this is a big topic question, so we'll tackle it as best we can. So Joe from Go Indie Now says, question for the show. With everybody and their brother nowadays offering editing services, how does one navigate through the muck? What would you say legitimizes them as editors? And what should we be looking for in hiring an editor? And how do you separate yourself from the rest? So that's a lot to unpack there. But it's an excellent point, though, because as authors are looking for freelance editors out there, there are a lot. There's a lot of people claiming to be editors who maybe aren't editors. And there's a lot of skill to editing that needs to be factored in. So let's break this down. Let's start with the first point of his question. With everybody offering editing services, how do you locate a good editor?
Going to conventions and writing events is a really good start. As I said, I meet a lot of my clients there. So having that face-to-face interaction, I think, really helps, because you can get a good read on people that way. But another thing I would suggest is going to your local editorial association. So here in Canada, it is the Editors Association of Canada. And there are a couple options there. There is a directory of editors, and editors will pay to have their name in the listing there, and it will list their specialties and things like that, so you can search there. There are also, I know my local branch does it, I don't know if every branch across Canada does it, but British Columbia has a job hotline as well. So you will send this hotline an email saying, hey, I'm looking for an editor, this is my manuscript, and they will pass that along in an email to all current members in BC. So that can be a good way to find, especially if you really want to find a local editor, going through a local association can be a good way to find one. I've also found a few clients through various writing Facebook groups. So just asking questions, but you definitely have to do your research to make sure you're finding a legitimate editor. But I think we'll get to that in another point in that question.
Anita brings up a good topic in the comment section. She says recommendations from other authors. And I agree with that. Your peers are often the best resource for you to locate somebody that you know will match the quality of what you expect. If, you know, Jane actually introduced me to my most recent editor because I needed an editor faster than my old editor was able to get me into her schedule. And because I know Jane's books are edited very well, I reached out to her editor, and I actually like working with her editor. So she's now doing my Agents of Asset series.
Yeah, recommendations and referrals are great.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if you've read someone's book and you really liked it, you think it was very well done, anything like that, you can a lot of times find out who the editor is. A lot of times they'll thank them at the end, maybe in the acknowledgments, or they might be on the copyright page, anything like that. And same thing as Ellen Michelle was saying, your name is very sayable together. I'm sorry.
Michelle is my last name, but that's okay.
No, just professional.
So yeah, I agree. Here I know Editorial Freelance Association, EFA, is where I would typically look. Like even when I was in a corporate job, when we were looking for editors of, you know, any kind of material we were working on, it was the EFA that we would look to first. Mm-hmm. Same kind of deal as what you were saying, Ellen. It's, you know, you want your name on that list. You have to pay yearly to be on it. And usually you're only doing that if you're very serious. You still want a sample edit from them.
Absolutely. You still need to do your vetting, but it's a good place to start.
Absolutely. So that's one way to find credible people. And I totally agree with everything you said. I have not yet myself seen an editor with like a booth at a convention. So I think it's really cool that that maybe you've seen that and you've done it. I mean, obviously you've done it. I don't know how much you've seen it, but I think that's a great idea. And I'd love to see more editors doing that kind of thing, because mm-hmm. authors are always looking for editors and publishing companies and things like that.
To clarify though, I get a booth because I also work as a bookseller. So I'm often at a booth at conventions, but when I'm behind the table, I'm focusing on book selling first because that's why I'm there. But at conventions, I'll also do presentations and be on panels and things like that. And I'll talk about my editing there. And I often have authors come up to me afterwards and say, oh, your talk was great. I'd love to talk to you about, you know, editing my manuscript. And then we go from there.
Yeah, definitely presentations and things like that. You can find them, you know, you can even go to like a writer's group. I was saying before the show started. So, you know, there are writing groups out there, like there are international ones, there are just local ones, chapters, all kinds of stuff that you can join. And a lot of times they'll have speakers, and those speakers, you know, one of them may be an editor. So you could definitely go there, meet them, see how you feel about them. Same kind of thing as what you're saying, Ellen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you meet a lot of really great authors and editors and publishers and everyone in the business there. I love going to conventions. They're a lot of fun.
It's hanging out with your people, like we were saying before the show.
Yeah. My work vacation, like I consider it a vacation. It's like fun, but I'm also working. It's great. It's the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Exact same thing. It's my working vacation. You work your butt off. You're dog tired by the end of the day, but you couldn't have had a better day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
My favorite weekends.
All right, well, let's unpack the second part of Joe's question. So we did talk about the services you guys offer and what the types of edits you offer. So he's asking what legitimizes an editor. We've kind of touched on that, so let's look at it in the reverse. What are some red flags authors should be looking for when they're trying to find a freelance editor?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I haven't thought too much about the red flags because I'm mostly trying to think about how to present myself well as an editor. Oh, thank you, Jason.
He's hiding there in the shadows.
He's lurking.
One thing I would like to point out, one thing I thought of was if their website has a lot of typos and errors. That's definitely a red flag. But like personally, I actually had another editor edit my website because as Christy, you must know because you're an author and an editor, you always have to have another person look at your work even if you are an editor yourself. And editors know that. So editors will get other editors to look at their website and proof it for them because it's so important. And also, you know, delayed responses to emails, like if they don't respond to you for over a month, then they're not considering their business as a priority. I mean, little things like that can pop up as red flags to me. I'm sure there are others, but Christy, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I want to definitely emphasize about the website for sure. That is one of the biggest red flags. There are a number of things, like you said, definitely typos. You know, not every author is going to know like the correct punctuation, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But the thing is, like, even if you go to their about page and it's a big rambly page with a lot of unnecessary information, that might happen to your manuscript. So just keep that in mind. The one thing, you know, this is the one place where being judgmental is actually on your side. You definitely want to be judgmental. And like, as two editors, we insist that you be judgmental about the website because we've both spent significant time on our websites. That editor should be poring over it. And, you know, things should be out of date. There shouldn't be, like, just saying there shouldn't be typos. It's not just there shouldn't be typos, like zero typos. Absolutely nothing should be a typo there because, like you said, Ellen, there should be a second set of eyes and the editor themselves should have looked over it many times. So, you know, this is their first like foot forward. So you need to make sure that the website is something that's going to impress you, makes you feel comfortable. Maybe the tone, the professionalism, things like that. Do they have a catalog that you can look at? Can you go and look up those books on Amazon and see what you think of them? Have they worked in your genre before? And if they haven't, you know, be careful. Just, I'm not saying they can't, but just be aware that if they haven't worked on it, you know, you may want to consider another person to be
safe. That's a big point. That's a fair point because genre expectations are different. And if you have an editor who, let's say, works in nonfiction most of the time, and you're throwing a romance novel at them, they might not be the right editor for that novel.
Oh,
yeah. No. There are a lot of genre specialties, and there are a lot of different niches and things that you need to pay attention to. That's why I specialize, and I've specialized since the beginning of my career in science fiction, fantasy, and horror crime. And I know those genres, and I know them really, really well. So I feel comfortable editing those manuscripts. If someone comes to me with a romance or an erotica, I refer them to someone else. I have a list of editors that I feel confident referring people to. And if it's not in my specialty, I'm not going to touch it because I know I can't do my best work with that genre.
And that's a really good point. It's not that an editor could not edit, because I want to make sure that our audience understands that. The editor could edit, yes, but they will not edit with the right tone or voice or genre expectations as one who works within that genre most of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing I wanted to point out, I thought of while Christy was talking about the last question, was they also need to list their education. Because as I mentioned earlier, I think editorial specific classes are so important for an editor to have, and ongoing professional development, because language changes and evolves and genres change and evolve. So professional development should be continuous and ongoing. And there should be evidence of that on their website, on their LinkedIn, on their resume, if they link that on their website. But it should be clear that they have that education and continue to work towards being a better editor.
Mm-hmm. We've got a question from the audience. Mike asks, do you ever consider expanding your specialization to include more genres? I think that's an interesting point because you're probably specializing in the genres you actually like.
Definitely, and that makes a difference. I would love to add more horror, crime, mystery to my day-to-day work. On my website and things, I list that I specialize in speculative fiction, which to me includes science fiction, fantasy, crime, mystery, and horror. I mostly get science fiction and fantasy, and that might be because there are more science fiction, fantasy related conventions that I'm going to, or there are just more people writing those books. I would love to work with more horror. I can't seem to find a lot of people writing horror these days, but I would love to expand to work on that stuff more. I don't see myself ever expanding into like romance or nonfiction genres. Because as Katie said, I'm working on what I enjoy and I'm good at those genres. So
that's even as a reader, it's hard to read outside of your genre. You know, if you're like authors will often go to another author to beta read, you know, to get the book in shape before it even goes to the editor. And if it's a genre that you're just not interested in, it's really hard to keep the focus there and to be able to give good critical feedback that's not, that's relevant.
Right.
Not the genre that you really like to read in. So I would assume just from my experience that an editor would be the same way, is you want them to be able to give that good critical feedback within the book that they're interested in. It's not boring them. It's not losing their interest because it's just not what they like. Christy, mm-hmm. how do you feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain things that, you know, on my website, I have what I specialize in, and there are a number of genres of that I specialize in. There are also ones that you won't find there. And there are ones that you'll find in my senior editors lists. And so we kind of cover a broad spectrum between us. And you have to be sort of, your editor should be willing to say, you know, this is really not what I do, if, you know, if that's not what they do. So, and if that's okay with you, fine. If it's not okay with you, they should give you the chance to go elsewhere, obviously. But I do want to point out one more thing, and that's the difference. Some editors handle only American English or only British English. And that is a huge difference. It is not something that you can just say, well, I guess it's kind of the same thing. It's just a different spellings. It's actually not. There are quite a number of rules that are completely different. So, you know, if you're looking at somebody's website and they say, I do US English, or they don't say, make sure that you ask. And don't, you know, if they say like, I handle American English, but you know, I'll do British English too. Where's your experience? Because, you know, it's a whole other ball game.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point, Christy. I know I have worked in American English and Canadian English both equally often because my clients seem to be split between the US and Canada. What about you, Christy? Because you are based in the US, what do you normally work with?
I do both. I do specifically list on my website that I do both. I've worked a lot with both languages, even in the corporate world. I worked on both as copy editor in a lot of different capacities. So, you know, but you know, they use different style guides. It's important. Yeah.
That's one thing I'd like to know.
Like, we could probably go on for a long time.
Yeah.
Using the right dictionary, you know?
Absolutely. One thing I would like to point out there, though, because you specifically said British and I specifically said Canadian, they are not the same thing. Canada does have its own English. There's American English, Canadian English, British English, Australian English, New Zealand English. There are a lot more varieties than people think. I know a lot of people seem to think that Canadian English is British English. It's very close. And Canadian English takes a lot from British English, but it has also taken a lot from American English. So it is kind of a hybrid. There are some things that are more American than British, and that can throw some people off. So
yeah,
they definitely are different. I just wanted to make that distinction.
To be clear, yes, good point. To be clear, my website says US and UK English specifically. Mm-hmm. Not, I don't say Canadian English on there. Yeah. So that's a very good point. And, you know, just to add to it, there's also slang that's different across all of these things. So, you know, if you receive a manuscript and you don't know the slang, you're kind of in trouble there. And it's not just about looking it up, but there's just a lot to it, you know.
Understanding the context of that slang, you can look at the definition, and the definition can tell you what it means, but it's not going to give you all of the context about what that means in specific situations. And that's not even just between like American and UK. It's also, I know slang in Eastern Canada is way different than slang in Western Canada. So even if I have to read people in Eastern Canada, because I'm like, I haven't heard this before. What's this mean?
You can point out somebody's whereabouts based on some of the words they use.
Even across
state lines here, there are different words that are used. So it's, understanding the common phrases, understanding common usage, it plays a very important role in it. But also, if you have an editor who, let's say, doesn't understand the phrase that you used, if you've got that communication with your editor, you've built that relationship with them, they'll ask. And then the editor, you know, learns something new, or you learn a better way of you know, phrasing it correctly. Maybe you used it wrong, because that's happened too.
And that's why the commenting function is so important, because I can just highlight it and say, did you mean to say this? Or does this mean what I think it means? And then we can have that kind of back and forth on it. Absolutely.
I mean, okay, for the convention goers, the nerds out there, or the geeks, sorry, geeks. when you make geeky references, an editor won't always get them, and you get the, you know, highlight WTF in the notes, and then you get to explain to your editor what you meant there, because you were calling a reference to something that, you know, is like geek culture.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Internet slang, everything.
Yeah. So the relationship, I think, is the most important part. But you bring up a lot of good stuff about the red flags that authors should be looking for when finding an editor, because there are a lot of people claiming to be editors out there. And as authors, you know, we want our work to look the best. We want to get what we pay for. And nothing hurts worse than paying for your book to be edited, getting it ready, publishing it, and then getting those comments in the review section that your editing wasn't on par. And the reviewers love to hit you up for editing. That's the first thing they're going to say, especially if they know you're an indie.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I've definitely gotten a fair amount of clients from people who have published. They had an editor, they've published, they've gotten totally ripped apart in the reviews for the poor proofreading or editing, and then they're looking for another editor. And maybe that's happened to you too, Ellen. You get somebody who says, my book is already out there, help. Like, it's really being ripped apart. Tell me what's wrong. And then you look at it, and a lot of times it's the proofreading. It's not always the editing. Many times it's the proofreading. It's as if it wasn't done at all. And that's where you need to look, again, back to the services. If a developmental edit is listed as just a developmental edit, and they don't mention anything about proofreading, know that it's not there. Like, note that the proofreading isn't there, because without the proofreading piece, you're in a lot of trouble. That's okay, but then be aware that you need to hire a proofreader. You can't just go off and publish your book with no proofreading at all. So that should save you a little bit of heartache.
One thing I'd like to note there too, that I just thought of when you were talking, is that even if an editor lists on their website that they do developmental and stylistic and copy editing and proofreading, just because they do it all doesn't mean they should be doing it all for your book. It's really important, if you are hiring a developmental editor and a copy editor and a proofreader, that those not necessarily be the same people. It's usually okay to have a developmental editor then work on a more detailed edit, because it's a very different brain wave function doing the developmental to the detailed work. But doing copy editing and proofreading, those should be two different people. And your typesetter should not be proofreading, because they typeset it, they designed it. They should not be doing your proofreading as well, because they'll miss things. Just like you as an author need to hire an editor because you get too close to the work and you start missing things. A copy editor to a proofreader, they're going to do the same thing.
Now, I will say, as a formatter, because I do freelance formatting, I don't read the book. I go by patterns. Mm-hmm. And a lot of formatters do just that. We look at the patterns. We look at the way the paragraphs are lining up, the indentations, the way it's justified on either side. We make it fit within the realm of the book. Mm-hmm. We don't read word for word. And I've done formatting for books in German. I don't read German. But once I format it, and it says specifically in my terms and conditions that I'm not reading, I'm not proofreading, I take the exact set of words that you give me and I put them into the place they're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So it's up to a author who's going through these steps to definitely understand that if you've hired an editor and then you've hired a formatter, that formatter is not reading your book. Mm-hmm. They're just putting the puzzle pieces together for you. You do need to make sure that somebody's looked at it. Doesn't necessarily have to be the professional proofreader. Give it to some friends. Readers find things all the time. And that could be a way for them to get that step covered. But yeah, if you want to make sure it is absolutely perfect, you definitely need to go the extra step of hiring another proofreader after the edit and formatting.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And then there was silence.
I think there was one more part to Joe's question.
Let me scroll up and look at it one more time, because I think we touched on a lot of it as we were answering other stuff. So we asked about legitimizing an editor. We asked about finding an editor. Okay, how do you separate yourself? That's the close of his question. How do you separate yourself from other editors out there?
I think for me, a lot of it is the specialization, as well as offering that sample edit, because not all editors do offer a sample edit. So that's one thing that well, Christy and I both always offer, so we can set ourselves apart that way. And yeah, just maintaining that author-editor relationship, being open to, you know, that communication and seeing what the author wants. And for me, if an author wants to have a Skype call with me to discuss their book at any point during the editing process, I always, like, a 1-hour call is always included in the price of the edit. So I'm open to that too, which I know some people might not be open to because they don't necessarily like, they like to be behind their screen kind of, and email is a lot more comfortable for some people, which is perfectly fair, but you know, that's one thing that can set my services apart a little bit. But honestly, I think it's mostly the specialization, because since the beginning of my career, I've focused on these genres and I've been reading them my whole life and I know them. I know them well.
Yeah, definitely. I would say word of mouth is, for me, one of the things that sets me apart. I get a lot of recommendations, which is great. And that is really my biggest form of marketing. I'm not really putting ads out there. It's really that clients are recommending me a lot. And that's fantastic. And it's the best way to get another client.
It's also so satisfying.
Yeah.
About the work that you're doing.
It is, you know, and one of the things you want to make sure, I do want to, this is one more thing that I thought, I'm sorry to interject this and not quite the right spot, but, you know, Ellen and I are talking about doing sample edits, and you just mentioned how not everyone does a sample edit. And one of the things that you want to be careful of in that sample edit is that you're not getting a yes man. And that's someone who sends it back with nothing to say really, except I like it and I want to work on it. And if you're getting something back with really no feedback, I would definitely try a few more sample edits from other people. I've had clients come to me, you know, with a sample edit, and they say, wow, I'm surprised you're the third sample edit I've had, and you're the only one who has said this, who's really given me a full critique. And so if you're getting someone who just wants your money, you know, because they're just saying, I like it, let's work together, there's no fixes at all, and they're not commenting on that, like, I'm surprised at the level of this manuscript, have you already had a proofread, or something like that. I just want to put that out there as another flag. So back to the subject, okay?
No, that's really important, yeah. The quality of that sample edit is very telling.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust someone who doesn't do a sample edit, so, you know.
And that's the point of the sample edit, is to show the critique that you're going to do on their manuscript. So if you give them back nothing, then what are they hiring you for?
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. I can't emphasize that enough for sure. So, and definitely the professionalism of the website. There are some, I mean, you can even say for some major authors, some of them don't have good websites. It's kind of weird. It's a little bit strange. And so occasionally there will be an editor with a not great website. I myself wouldn't hire them. But for the most part, you want to see professionalism in that website. You want to see professionalism in the communication. You shouldn't be having such a casual conversation that it's just sort of like, this is your best friend who's not going to tell you much of anything. You know, they're really trying to people please you again, you know. That's not what you want. So I would say that's another thing that makes me stand out. I've seen plenty of people who say, I love editing. They have no experience. Like Ellen was saying that you need to look for the experience and things like that. I've seen lots of people say, I just really like to edit.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, I've read a lot of books. And that is also lacking the professionalism of saying, here's my catalog. Email anyone you want. You know, like, talk to me on the side. You know, there's a lot of things like that that I think sets a good editor apart.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to slightly counter one thing that you said, just from my own experience. Professionalism is absolutely important, and you always need to be professional in communication. But I've had a few clients who get nervous when the professionalism is too, like, on that really high, this mm-hmm. professional communication level. Some of them prefer to have more of a casual social kind of chat, and it's still a professional relationship, and they're still the author and I'm still the editor that they're hiring. But the way that I talk to my clients varies client to client, because I know some of them better than others, and some of them prefer that high professional level of communication, so I give that to them. But the other ones who are maybe a little bit younger, are brand new authors, aren't really sure how things work, I sometimes have a lot more casual conversational style with them, because that's what makes them feel more comfortable.
So I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. There are different levels. Professionalism is professionalism. It does not mean being cold or you know, being like rigid or anything like that. So I totally agree. It's a great clarification. And there are definitely authors that I'm more, I do have a friendship with that results, you know, from editing and stuff. I guess what I was thinking of is I know someone who got a book edited. It was, I got them as a client because it was badly done and it was published, and they came to me and asked, you know, could you help me with this manuscript? It's already up. It's kind of an emergency. And what I was seeing was in the conversation, like some of the conversation was like, just as if there was no work involved. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit hard to describe because I'm not looking to say that kind of conversation out loud, but it was just so like no barrier, no profession. I guess that would be no professionalism. I guess that would come down to that. So I guess that's what I'm trying to maybe warn you away from, someone who's really looking for a friend more than someone who's really taking your work seriously. So that's a really good distinction to make, for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, always be professional with your clients and with your editor, but there are different levels to that. And, you know, and that's another thing about that author-editor relationship is you need to feel comfortable talking to that person and you need to feel comfortable in that relationship. So if my client wants to be more professional or more casual, then that's fine. That's what we'll do. If someone wants to communicate only by email and always, always, always only by email, that's fine. If someone wants to give me updates or wants me to give them updates in some other form, like a Facebook message, or because I've met a few of my clients through Facebook and we start our communication on Facebook Messenger, if they want to continue receiving updates that way, then that's fine. I mean, whatever works better and more efficiently for them, I'm perfectly happy to accommodate that.
And each professional relationship between author and editor is going to be different depending on the client. And it's good that you develop that relationship with the author as you're working with them, and you give them the opportunity to show you what they want from you, as well as, you know, show them what you're willing to give. Mm-hmm. And that actually bridges into a question from Joe. He's on fire tonight with the good questions. He has asked us, what is the one thing that you want your authors to do before they send you something? And this is important because you're going to be seeing a lot of the raw stuff as an editor, but there are some things that maybe you want them to have kind of a checklist before they send it to you. Maybe it's a edit that's a series where you've worked with them on a book before and there's a couple of things that you already know that they need to look at. Or maybe it's a first-time author who's about ready to dump their wonderful manuscript on you that is in questionable condition. So what do you look for initially, or what would you want authors to do initially before actually starting the edit with you?
Well, one thing I would say is before you even hire an editor is do a couple rounds of self-editing. Like, you definitely need to hire an editor at the end of it, but you can take care of a lot of things yourself, and that will make your edit cheaper as well, because then there's less for your editor to deal with. But in terms of a checklist, I mean, I have a checklist of things that I do at the start as soon as I get a manuscript. And they're things that an author could do, but not necessarily anything that I would expect the author to do. These are things like making sure the paragraph spacing and indentation has been done with like the paragraph styles instead of with tab. And that's a really easy, you know, find and replace or select all, change paragraph styles. Like it's really quick and easy for me to do that. So it would actually take me longer to explain to the author via email how to do those things than it would take for me to actually do them myself. So like I have a checklist like that, and especially with words that are commonly misspelled between American, Canadian, British English. So as soon as I know which English I'm working in, I'll look for those common words like toward and towards, or color with a U or without a U. So I'll do a, you know, universal find and replace for those kinds of things at the start. But I wouldn't necessarily expect the author to do that before they give it to me, because that's part of what they've hired me for. If they've done it already, then that's great. But if not, that's, you know, it's quick and easy for me to do those things right at the start.
For sure, reading the manuscript through a few times. I have gotten manuscripts that I am absolutely sure the editor has not gone back and read it. It's a rough draft, you know? And that's the kind of thing that an editor might reject because it's really not worth the author's money even. You're telling them such basic things that they can fix by themselves. But even so, if you send me something that is really barely worked on by you, you're not going to get your money's worth anyway, because I'm teaching you things now. Like, I'm teaching you basics. I'm going back to basics of the plot line and the character development that simply aren't there and that I'm sure you would have seen if you had taken the time. You know, like, a lot of it is very obvious stuff. It's not the stuff you need an editor for necessarily. There are certainly authors who don't know that there are... That's what you hire us for, right? Plot holes and character development. However, there's a line. There's the line where you know that it hasn't been read. So that's not really worth it. That's one of the biggest reasons I wouldn't send that kind of a thing, because it's not worth your money. How deep can I get if the plot line is, you changed it like three times, you know? If there isn't like an underlying, like, where are we going? What are we doing? What's the point? How am I going to really get deep? You're going to have to rehire someone to do this again once you do the basic fixes that should have been there in the first place. So I would say that that's like the most important thing that I could really say to make sure you've done. Absolutely. If you're writing, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, it's always great to make sure your terms are used properly. I've definitely run into, of course, like, our job is to go through and make sure it's done correctly, and we can always be in contact with you. You know, Ellen and I have made super clear that communication is very important. I have run into those manuscripts where it seems like the jargon used was just thrown together a bit. So taking a look at that and just making sure you know what your own jargon means is a good idea. This stuff seems so basic, but it does happen. So, you know, it's important to look at that stuff first so you get the highest quality edit you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Along with the jargon thing, you know, making sure not only that they're used correctly, but used consistently.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend, especially for science fiction fantasy authors, a glossary. And some people will include it in the final published book and some people won't. Like, it can really go either way. But even if you aren't planning on publishing a glossary, make one, give it to your editor. It helps so much. Whenever I start an edit, I always ask for as many resources that they have. If they have a character list, a family tree, a map, a glossary, anything like that can help. Because if they don't give it to me, I'm making it as I go, and that takes me longer, which means the edit takes longer, which means the edit is more expensive. If you've already done that work, if you already have those resources, give them to your editor, because it will help them make sure that things are consistent throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would also say if you have any particular concerns, it is great if you communicate them, because we're, of course, going in cold, except for the sample edit. We're going in pretty cold. Maybe we have an idea of what you're trying to accomplish, but we're going to do our best to make it great. But if you have a particular concern, it really does help to sort of just have that in mind the whole time and to know, okay, this person is really worried about this. And sometimes it's unfounded. Like, there's really no reason. You did a great job. There's no problem. But sometimes it just helps to have that extra little bit of information on, you know, the concerns there.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. And I know Katie was talking about crutch words. This might have been before we went live. But she was saying how her editor knows what her crutch words are, the words that she overuses a little bit too much. So if you have those, tell me. Don't try and hide them from me. And I can, you know, either, as Christy said, reassure you that, no, you're fine, or help you get better.
Yeah, I was given like a limit of how many times I'm allowed to use those words within 8,000 words. I have to do a search and find. And once I've hit my limit, I have to remove all the other words and find another word for its place. And it actually trained me, though, to, before I send anything to an editor now, I do have a list of things that I do. And I look for my crutch words. I looked for my overused expressions. I look for dialogue tags that I tend to overuse. And I make sure I go through all of them before I send them to my editor. And as advice from an author to other authors out there, do a beta read. Have some people look over your manuscript in its entirety, read it as a book. That way you can get feedback before you go off to editing. So if there are some plot holes, readers will tend to find them. If there are some issues with your characters acting funny, readers will tend to find them. And other authors make great beta readers, especially if you develop a relationship within the indie community. There's tons of different communities around Facebook, around Twitter, filled with indies exchanging these kinds of services with each other to help each other grow. And so if you have a couple people who can beta read for you, they might pick up some of these things so you can clean up the manuscript. So again, the editor has less to do when they get it, and you get a cleaner, faster turnaround on your editing.
Mm-hmm. I like that you have that checklist that you do, but I will note that because you're an experienced author, you probably didn't do that with your first book, right? Because you wouldn't have known.
No, so learning process.
Exactly. So for all the new authors and first-time authors out there, if you're not already doing these things, that's fine. That's why you hire an editor. And a lot of editors actually specialize in working with first-time authors. Most of my clients are first-time authors. And that's very different than working with experienced authors, because there are these kind of learning curves that you need to help those authors with. And honestly, that's why I love working with newer authors. It's a lot of fun to help them learn, help them figure out what the best way to do things is and how the publishing industry works. And we were talking about services earlier, and another thing that I offer to clients I've worked with on editing is what I call a publishing consultation. And in this, I'll have either a phone or a Skype chat with the author, and I'll help them, I'll explain to them the differences, you know, between traditional publishing, self-publishing, what vanity publishing is and why you should probably avoid it, and help them pick the right path for them, and do a little bit of publisher and agent research if they are going traditional, and help them with query letters or blurbs, depending if they are going traditional or self-publishing. And that I've had quite a few of my first-time authors take me up on that service, and they learn a lot in that process. And I enjoy that process as well.
Oh, guys, we are over time. I know we could talk for hours on just the editing topic. There are some questions in the comments. So after the show's over, if you guys want to pop over to our Spilling Ink page, maybe you can answer some of the questions we didn't get to that were in the comments section. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to invite you guys back again sometime to continue the discussion, because it is a very important discussion for not only new authors, but even experienced authors can learn a thing or two from different editors and different approaches to editing.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds great.
Definitely.
So we'll close off the show for now. I want to thank everyone for hanging out with us. Your questions in the chat today were wonderful. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but we'll definitely take a look afterwards, and we will set up another editing panel probably later this summer so that we can really dive into some more of your questions. And Christy, Ellen, it has been wonderful having you here today. I hope we can definitely get you back.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been great.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, guys, that's it for this week's edition of Spilling Ink. We'll be back again soon with more authors, more professionals in the publishing industry. And until then, have a great night. Bye, guys.